This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Two of the biggest companies you may never have heard of are getting hitched.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Good morning. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Today, the mining company Xstrata agreed to get together with the commodities trading firm Glencore in a $90 billion merger. I don't blame you if you've never heard of those companies, but just for some context, $90 billion is the ballpark of what analysts say Facebook is going to be worth when it goes public. Joining us now to demystify this merger is John Meyer. He's an analyst, mining analyst with Fairfax Investment Bank, and he's with us now from Cape Town, South Africa. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, tell me, first of all, why this deal matters within the mining industry.
This deal is a landmark for the industry. It ties up one of the world's largest miners, which is particularly important in copper and coal, with the world's largest and arguably most successful trading company, which is critical in the supply of raw materials into manufacturing companies around the world.
So you've got a company that can then both mine the material and then sell it.
Yes. In many cases, a miner will go through a trading company which has better connections with the manufacturers and the end users, particularly good connections into China, the Eastern Bloc, really tentacles all over the planet, and is critical to global trade.
Why does it matter to ordinary Americans? How do we interact with these companies, even if it's far down the chain?
It's really important from a safety perspective that the companies that produce these products, these specialty steels or consumer electronics products, where we depend on the structural integrity of that steel so that our railways are safe, so that our cars hold together in the right way, so that our houses are structurally sound.
John Meyer is a mining analyst at Fairfax Investment Bank. John, thanks.
You're very welcome.
Now to Washington, where the Senate is working on some legislation this week aimed at boosting the nation's defenses against cybercrime. But as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports, utility companies oppose the new regulation because they say it'll allow too much government intrusion into their business.
Most of America's critical infrastructure is owned and operated by private companies. Increasingly, they use network software, making them vulnerable to hackers. Jacob Olcott is a cybersecurity expert at Good Harbor Consulting. He says given the potential catastrophic consequences of an attack,
many people are coalescing around the idea that the government does play a role, some role, in protecting those systems and assets.
But companies are warning Congress not to add to their regulatory burden. Liesl France, for example, with Tech America, says new government requirements could make it tougher to react.
Probably a most salient example is the time it takes to devise and promulgate and enforce a regulatory framework vis-a-vis the time that it takes for a cyber attack to occur.
France says instead of imposing new regulations, government should make it easier for industries that are under threat to quickly share information. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
And let's do the numbers. Stocks are mostly lower in overseas trading this morning, down about 0.2% in London, 0.5% right now in Frankfurt. Here in this country, still no deal on that big settlement between states and banks over abusive foreclosure practices, though they say they are close. On Wall Street yesterday, the Dow slipped 17 points to close at 12,845.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Ohio is the latest state to turn to its liquor industry for jobs. The state recently transferred control of its booze-buying arm to a state-funded, privately-run job creation agency called Jobs Ohio. And this deal couldn't have come at a better time for Jobs Ohio. Liquor sales are up for imported spirits and homegrown libations. Brian Bull of WCPN reports from Cleveland.
Last year was one of the rainiest ever in Northeast Ohio. Not the best weather if you raise grapes. But Nick Ferrante of Ferrante Winery in Geneva, Ohio, is toasting 2011 anyway because of strong sales.
We just loaded like 15 cases of wine into a gentleman's cart. So I think we're going to finish strong, maybe 5 or 6%.
Over last year?
Yes, I think so.
The Ohio Department of Commerce says there are now 164 licensed winemakers, about a third more than there was 5 years ago. The number of licensed beer makers has nearly doubled from 2007. Commerce head David Goodman says alcohol sales in Ohio are at record highs.
So far this year, we're at approximately $770 million in revenue, which is historic.
That growth jibes with national alcohol sales. Craft breweries in particular have seen beer sales improve over the last 2 years. Good news for companies like the Great Lakes Brewing Company based in Cleveland. Its kegging line rolls barrel after barrel almost nonstop. Co-owner Patrick Conway says Great Lakes saw record sales last year, up 30% over 2010. And he added 20 new positions.
And we are penciling in another healthy double-digit growth for next year, I think around 20, 25%.
Seems like most alcohol makers share these high hopes, including entrepreneurs like Tom Licks, who will introduce his Cleveland whiskey brand next summer. While many startups are dealing with post-recession jitters, Licks is confident.
5 years from now, we'll be a $50 million company, employ 35 or 40 people, and I think that'll be a great success for us.
In an economy where it seems every major industry has dried up, alcohol flows on. In Cleveland, I'm Brian Bull for Marketplace.
And finally, the ratings are in, and the Super Bowl was the most watched TV program in U.S. history. 111.3 million people tuned in. But get this, the halftime performance by Madonna drew even more viewers, 114 million. According to TheWrap.com, the halftime performance was also a hit on Twitter with 10,245 tweets per second, all of them extremely interesting, I'm sure. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.